All right. Continuing the book of Esther, Esther chapter 6. This is where it all gets to start to have fun. A little bit of humor, a little bit of twists and turns, and a whole lot of providence. Esther chapter 6. On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." And the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is here standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" And Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's noblest, most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Then the king said to Haman, "Hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned." So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." While they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. This is the fun chapter, you know, because you see it, you know it's coming. You just sense it, you feel it, you're just waiting. And it's interesting because you notice the king can't sleep this night. This after a feast with drinking, and yet he still can't sleep.
Well, after 4 hours, the soporific effect of wine goes away, and you're actually more awake.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting. I wonder if that was the case for him.
Could have
been. Could be. Regardless, providence was here. It just so happens, right? Just so happens that this night, the king can't sleep. The night between the feasts. The night where Haman, while he's at home, lamenting his situation, recounting all his riches and all his wealth and all his promotions to his family and friends, that he counts it all as nothing so long as Mordecai the Jew lives. And so his wife and friends come up with this plan, build gallows, 75 feet tall, to have him hanged or impaled or crucified on them. And so this seems like a great plan. And so that's when Haman comes in. But it's on this night that the king can't sleep. And so he gives orders to bring the book of memorable deeds. No doubt memorable deeds of the king, mostly. But, you know, there's slight bias in the reporting, you know, no objectivity, I'm sure. But the memorable deeds, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. Then you get to verse 2. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Well, we remember that story. That was what happened at the end of chapter 2, where Mordecai uncovered the plot. So it just so happens that the guy reading the deeds and the chronicles just happens to come across the story of Mordecai. Now, honestly, how often do you think Mordecai was really mentioned in the deeds of the book of the Kings here? Probably not all that much. But he just so happens to turn to this portion of the scroll, and there's Mordecai's story. Coincidence? No, of course not. From our perspective, wow. You know, the world would say, talk about dumb luck. Well, luck is dumb. They got that right. but there's no coincidences here. And this chapter is just filled with providence.
Didn't we say that was probably more than 6 months earlier?
Also? Probably, yeah. At least, minimum.
Yeah.
Because there's no indication where that time frame was. Somewhere within that 5-year time span between when Esther became queen and when Haman got promoted and the plot came out. So somewhere in that 5-year time span. So it could have been earlier on. So this could be as much as 5 years later. And, you know, the king, for whatever reason, decides to ask, well, what honor did we bestow upon him? You know, you think about that. He didn't have to ask that. He probably would have, unless it was something more recent, or unless it triggered his memory, but we really don't know. You know, he asks the question, why, what have we done for this man? And then he finds out, well, nothing. Nothing has been done for him. So the king says, who's in the court? And you notice once again, the king can't figure out what to do for himself. He can't figure it out. Who's in the court so we can figure out what we can do for Mordecai? And then comes Haman. Haman comes in with a purpose. And what's Haman's purpose? To have the king hang Mordecai. You know, he's angry. He's got this whole plan concocted in his head. His wife turned his head to have Mordecai killed. And he goes in. And as soon as he enters, the king asks him a question. What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? Haman can't say hang him because he automatically assumes what?
It's got to be me.
Who else could it be? It's me. The king loves me. All these promotions. All these honors and riches. And I've got his signet ring still. Not only that, the queen invites the king and me alone. So I'm in good shape. So the king has to mean me. And, you know, doesn't even dawn on Haman here that it's the middle of the night and the king's awake. He's just had his ego stroked. Whom would the king delight to honor more than me? What a profound question, huh? But you know what? Isn't it? Let's be honest here. Are there not times you sort of, in your life, imagined, you know, getting a little recognition, everybody recognizing your good deeds for something, congratulating you, giving you a hand for all your hard work and something. It's kind of hard not to at certain points, because you see it happen to other people and you think, wow, I wonder what it would be like to have people stand and cheer for me, or just give me gifts, or something. Write an article about me. You know, all these things, various things that people come up with. Give me a promotion for all my hard work. You know, you've worked hard. How about a raise? But Haman, of course, is the epitome of an ego trip, where he sits there with his family and brags about his money, brags about himself, brags about his promotions, and how the king honors him. So, of course, he's going to assume this. Ever know people like this? Yeah. It's true. It's kind of sad. And, you know, what we say when people like that are in the room, it's like, I can't breathe. And things like that. How do you get through the door with that big head? And things like that. You know, all types of arguments and statements that we have for such arrogance and pride. Now, what does the Book of Proverbs talk about with respect to pride? Foolish comes before a fall. Anything else? Those are the two biggies, of course. What's that?
Pride comes.
Yeah, pride comes before the fall. And then the Lord hates haughty eyes. Haughty, proud eyes. And Haman's going to find that out pretty soon. It's not going to be much longer for him. Bethany?
In verse 1 where he's reading about the guy is reading Elijah King about his chronicles. Do you think the king just kind of just wants to hear about himself, like Haman was talking about himself?
Probably. It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, Ahasuerus was a king after all. Although he can't figure out how to honor the man whom he delights in. It's just mind-boggling, some of these things. You know, Haman, for all his shrewdness, couldn't figure out, well, just have Mordecai killed. His wife had to figure it out for him. And so off he goes. Oh, okay.
Maybe this was the providential way of drawing Haman further into it.
Yeah.
Making Haman devise the reward so that he could be even madder because he had to give it to Mordecai.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. Yeah.
I just think it's interesting that also he talks to his friends about all his successes, and then he goes back and he mourns to his friends after all this happened.
Yeah.
And he's just mourning with them. After he just had his ego put up and all, and he's not embarrassed to come back and start mourning to them about all the horrible things that happened.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting that at the end he's not embarrassed enough and not humiliated enough to tell his wife and family and friends again. I don't know, I'd be kind of embarrassed myself. I don't know. You know, you can almost picture the wife as, so honey, how did it go with the boss? Yeah, well, it didn't go so well. Instead of having Haman hanged, I had to lead him around on a horse with a crown and a robe. You know, it's just all these humorous twists in the story.
Jesus make haste and do it? Did he lead him around on the horse in the middle of the night?
I don't know that it was the middle of the night, but it probably wasn't long after. Probably in the morning.
Probably by the time all the preparations were made, probably by then light.
Yeah, you got to go wake up all the servants, you know, the stables.
Honor somebody in the middle of the night. There's nobody around.
Yeah,
see it. So it has to be probably in the morning where the people around are starting to be awake and in the square and all that.
And right after he gets back home and mourns to his wife and friends, they come and grab him for the next banquet.
Yeah,
so it's not going to be a breakfast banquet.
Like
right.
Daytime,
so the leading around had to have been during the morning.
Yeah. So, you got to figure, you got to get all the robes, you got to get the crown. The crown's over here, the robes are over there. Of course, you got to go find the horse, the right horse. You got to feed the horse, water the horse, saddle the horse, all of that. And then you got to get, you know, you got to summon Mordecai.
He's dressed Mordecai.
Yep. Did you notice that? He had to dress Mordecai himself.
Yep. Like Mordecai, Haman's dressing him. Oh, you skipped the robe. Ugh.
Yeah.
Stink.
I mean, years and years ago, I was playing softball, and I tried to make a Mickey Mantle, Joe DiMaggio catch. Well, it didn't work out so well, and I sprained my wrist. It was Mother's Day weekend. And the fear was, when I went to the ER, I just wanted to make sure it wasn't broken. But the fear was because I had traumatized my thumb just enough that I couldn't lift it. So there was thought that I might have ruptured one of the tendons there. So they wrapped me up. My thumb is sticking out, wrapped up completely throughout the whole weekend, Mother's Day weekend. So with my hand like this wrapped up, guess what I couldn't do? Tie my shoes. And so my wife, my dear wife, on Mother's Day is having to tie my shoes for me. I mean, I felt so bad. And it turns out it was just, you know, it was just the trauma of the moment, because once I got the bandage off, I was able to move it in the correct motions again. But it's that kind of thing. You know, she had to help tie my shoes. But that was out of really more of a necessity. This is even worse, because here he comes in. I'm going to ask the king to have him hung on my gallows, and I'm going to have to lead him around. Not only am I going to have to lead him around, I have to dress him. A man who does not need help being dressed. The man who holds the signet ring of the king has to dress the man who he wants to kill.
And give him what
he wants.
Julia? I think it's kind of interesting how he's like, the king doesn't say, how should I treat Mordecai after he does this?
He's That's like, right.
How should I
honor the man the king delights in? Yeah. You notice that? I mean, that's a good point. Another one of those things. He happens to ask the question the way he does. And so that just puffs Haman up. Who else could it be but me?
Mordecai goes along with it. There's no word.
Mordecai says nothing in this chapter. You notice that?
I've seen you in times where you just, that's not to say anything.
Yeah, there are times.
Makes the situation all the more amazing.
Yeah.
When you've worked with teams and they're in trouble, and you know when to just be silent.
And sometimes just standing there and being silent was enough.
Carries more weight.
Yeah. There was one time I was with a friend of mine. I was helping him, of all things, buy some bookshelf speakers, because I kind of like audiovisual equipment, and he kind of asked my advice. Well, I went with him. And we had to special order a certain pair for his TV and so forth, so that the magnets in the speaker wouldn't ruin his TV. This is before flat screen TVs were big. So we go to the stereo store together, and the salesman who had the speakers ready we wanted to test them to make sure they worked before we left. So the guy was trying to be really slick. And he took the speaker and he flipped it. And like he was going to catch it, but he dropped it. And it, you know, of course it broke. It was like really smashed into the wood and so forth. It was only about this big of a speaker. And there it is. It's on the floor. And he's kind of crouched down looking at it. And me and my friend, we just stood there and looked. Didn't say a word. And well, got him another speaker and a discount. So sometimes it is best not to say anything. Not a word. Just let the silence hang. And that's what Mordecai does. We don't have anything. You know, it's funny because the VeggieTales version of the Book of Esther, as fun as it is, you don't see the parade at all. But you see Mordecai coming back into the house, and he's like, thanks for the parade, Haman. You know, something like that. But we don't even have that. So notice all these things that he has to do. Right? For the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought in. And if I had to guess, there's probably a lot of purple in there. The text doesn't say that, but purple was typically a royal color. It was hard to make. Today it's no big deal, but we think purple, hey, I like purple, I'm going to go get a purple shirt. But purple in those days was hard to come by. And to make, I guess it was difficult to make as well. So you have the royal robes, which the king himself has worn. So there's this sort of aura about it. It's kind of like, you know, when, you know, players and sports teams, they take their jerseys after winning and throw them up to the stands. And, the fans are scrambling for it like crazy. And the guy who gets it, they're jumping, I got it, I got it. And I'm thinking, that's disgusting. You know, but it's this kind of thing. The king's robes that he himself has worn.
I bet one of them had a wine stain.
I'm sure there's probably some wine stains. Maybe. You never know.
Hence the purple.
There you go.
Hides the wine stain.
Maybe that's why purple was so rare, you know. And then the horse that the king has ridden too. It's his car. He's given him the keys to his car. Yeah, right. And funny you should mention that. I was just thinking of a story of somebody I knew. This is many years ago when I was working a summer at the camp. The facilities manager at the time owned a nice classic Mustang. And he was heading out for a few days. And he said to one of the other staff members, he goes, you know, just take care of the dog, because he had a hunting dog that lived in the house and on the grounds too. And, you know, just check this and check that. And, you know, the keys to the Mustang are on the table. And the other guy's like, oh, yeah. So there it was. So, and that's exactly what I was thinking of. You know, he got the keys to the car, the vet, the garage, the Maserati, whatever it was. Yeah.
Did he crash the car?
Well, not here. No, he didn't then.
Your story.
What's that?
Your story.
My story.
Yeah.
What about it?
Yeah,
no. He didn't crash it. No, that's what I had said. He didn't crash it. I should ask him if he still has that car. I'm friends with his wife on Facebook, but it's been many years. Anyway, I digress. But yeah, putting him on the horse that the king has ridden, and then on his head, a royal crown is set. So royal crown, or, you know, my footnote here has headdress. It could be either one, really. So there he is. He's dressed like a king himself, riding the king's horse, wearing the king's robe. Nobody is going to miss this. Into the square of the city where everything is happening.
And Mordecai's a Jew.
And Mordecai's a Jew leading him around.
No, Mordecai's a Jew.
Or being led around, right.
And all the people in confusion because the Jews are threatened.
That's an interesting point. Because not that long ago, the Jews were in mass confusion because of this decree that went out that they're all going to be killed. Yet Mordecai the Jew is being led about. This is the honor for the one whom the king delights in. And so,
does anybody know that Mordecai is a Jew?
I'm sure the Jews knew he was a Jew.
Haman
certainly knew he was a Jew.
The king is calling him a Jew.
The king called him a Jew. So it was written down that he was a Jew. We still don't know yet, publicly, so to speak, even though we do, because we're reading the story, there's still no connection between Mordecai and Esther yet.
The Jewish males may have done their hair or beards differently.
Yeah, they could have.
They may have worn slightly different clothing as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if he had phylacteries or anything.
Yeah, any of that.
The king knew who Mordecai was.
Yeah.
Knew where he hung out at the gate.
Yeah, well, he was an officer in the king's palace area, so he knew something of him, and he probably remembered, oh, yeah, I remember that.
Did he even make the connection that his days were numbered according to his decree?
Probably not.
Apparently not.
Didn't even think.
But you know, the decree, though, that went out, there's no indication that the king actually saw the decree. Because remember, when Haman came to the king with this plot, there's a certain people.
Right. He was
they have different customs and different laws. Well, that was kind of a truism. They all did. So what? There was nothing new there. And the king didn't write it out. He just gave his signet ring to Haman. So Haman wrote it and signed it with the king's signature, basically. So he probably never saw the decree. Trish? It was.
The order of the king is his signet ring.
Yeah.
Right.
So he didn't have to know what it was.
No.
Yeah.
But it's still pathetic that he doesn't know.
Right. You know, right, he doesn't know.
he's got to look for the very best wine.
That's right. Exactly. And the purple robe to cover it.
Let's see now. 625 B.C. That was a pretty good year.
Right. Exactly. So you have a king who doesn't know what's going on. Now, this probably, you know, having probably not read the decree itself, is probably reminiscent of something I heard on the news not that long ago. We have to pass it in order to see what's in it.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, never mind.
Exactly.
Same idea. So, there it is.
Okay, more. If you're a Jew in that time and you saw what was happening, you'd be a little...
You'd probably be even more confused.
A little more comforted at the same time.
Comforted, maybe, but confused.
Maybe they're thinking Mordecai's turned his back on them.
That could be, too.
Yeah.
There could be any number of things going through the Jews' minds who may have been in the square witnessing this. And the author tells us none of them.
Yeah,
well, it could be. So, yeah.
It seems to me that Haman's, like, really boastful when it comes to, like, the good things about his life, but he comes really whiny when it comes to bad things.
That's usually true of most people who struggle with pride.
Yep.
Yep. And when any of us in here have struggled with pride in the past, I'm sure it's happened to all of us. And what's the first thing that usually comes out of our mouths? It's not fair.
All together
now, right, exactly. We all know. We know what it's like. How could this happen to me? That's right, that's right. So here we go. The robes are on them. And not only that, let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. And you know, if you were to make sort of a film adaptation of this scene, there's so many things, humorous things that you could probably add to this. You could picture Haman, thus shall it be done to the man, the king. Louder, Haman, they can't hear you. You know, that kind of thing. What?
Shakespeare would have had a great time with it.
Shakespeare would have had a load of fun with it. Yes?
He's driving his Maserati in the middle of the square.
That's right. He's being chauffeured in the Maserati around the square.
And then Haman's probably got the old thing, the old junkie car. It's like,
well, yeah, he's probably riding a mule pulling the king's horse, but we don't really know. But there he is out in the square. Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. And then the king's reaction. Great, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew. And this is one of those situations. Wouldn't you just wish that there was a picture to see the look on Haman's face? And, you know, there have been a couple of times in my life that I can recall that I just wish a snapshot of certain individuals' faces in you know, and I realize there's a little hint of vindictiveness on my side when I say that. But you see, what's the look on their face when a realization hits them? And yet at the flip side, I also recognize that there are probably times I really hope there was never a camera on me when the realization has hit me. What did my face just look like when, whoops?
And, you know, the king
king must have realized something, because then he added, leave nothing out that you have said. Just kind of like, make sure.
Yeah, make sure it is all done. And you got to figure, the guy who's reading the story is probably writing this stuff down, too.
Yeah. He did. It's here.
It's here. Right. Well, we don't know that the scribe wrote this, but we certainly know the story. And so, do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. And verse 11, it's just put there matter-of-factly. Isn't that amazing the way the author does this? No comment, just here's what happened. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. No comments, no judgments, no humorous statements. There it is. He just lets it stand for itself. And anybody reading this can just see the humor as it was in this situation. The sad humor, really. Just, you see this comedy twisted around. It's like a Shakespearean comedy. It really is. Juliana?
Was Mordecai still in the sackcloth?
No, not at this point, no. He probably was.
Up until then. Yeah, hard to say.
I mean, did they like have to get him out of sackcloth?
Certainly did. If he wasn't in sackcloth, whatever he was in, he had to get out of, and Haman had to dress him. A full-grown man, you have to dress, who can perfectly well dress himself. The man you hate and despise, you have to dress. Yeah.
I bet he likes.
Well, we don't know that. He probably didn't, but that's not a way to honor the man whom the king delights in. As much as Haman hated Mordecai, he wasn't going to cross the king. So.
Then he can lose all his promotions.
Yeah, well, he will lose his promotions pretty soon, so that's not going to take much longer. But notice then, you know, then we start to get a little bit more serious. In verse 12, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning. Mourning. And with his head covered. So now who's the one in mourning and with his head covered? It's not Mordecai anymore. It's Haman. But it's over himself. That's it. He's mourning over himself. Woe is me. Poor me.
Because ultimately one person won't bow to him.
Because ultimately one person won't bow to him.
Mourning over this? Or is he mourning over the potential implication that the king is honoring Mordecai? How is that going to
react? All the above.
That's true.
Probably, I don't know. That could be the case, but there are indications that Haman may not have been that smart to figure that, to think that far.
Yeah. Look at the advice that
his... Yeah, the advice from his wife.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, too. We'll come to that, his advice, that advice in a minute. So Haman tells his wife, Zeresh, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. So he calls another party, so to speak. But this one is more of a wake. You know, because now he's mourning. And notice, this is what the wise men and his wife, Zeresh, said to him. If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. Now, that's an interesting statement, because if you go back to chapter 5, at the end of chapter 5 in verse 14, well, even before that, because in verse 13, this is where he says, yet all this, all his wealth and his promotion, all this is worth nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. And so Zeresh comes up with this plan. Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. That's the question, though. Does she really? It makes you wonder if... You know, In the same way that for Israelites, even throughout history, long after the facts, and even as I mentioned previously a couple of weeks ago, as recently as the 1960s, the phrase Agagite being used to enemies of the people of Israel just happened to be a pejorative slur. It makes you wonder if Zeresh, the first time she heard Mordecai the Jew, just thought that Haman just called him a Jew because it was a pejorative slur. But this time coming around, it seems that she's come to the realization he really is a Jew. Of the Jewish people. And so notice that she also is smart enough to recognize what is starting to happen. If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people. So there's almost this sense of doubt, but she's starting to realize if he really is a Jew, Haman doesn't stand a chance. And how fascinating it is, the amount of faith in the God of the Jews by this woman's statement. I don't mean saving faith, a faith of recognition of who God is.
Especially in light of that decree that's going to annihilate all the Jews.
Especially in light of that decree. There's no way that Haman's wife doesn't know about this decree, because Haman brags too much. And yet, despite that, if he really is of the Jewish people, before whom you have begun to fall. What a hugely profound statement that is. She doesn't want to be part of this anymore.
You will surely
fall. Yep. You will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. Quite a prediction there. One that will come about rather quickly from this point on. And so while they were in the midst of this talking, even though we have no response from Haman, the king's eunuchs come in to grab Haman and bring to the feast. And at this point, you know what's coming. You just know it. You can sense it. You can feel it. Everything has led up to this. The plot has turned and twisted so far that there's no going back.
In the original, I'm reading the NIV, and the NIV says that this woman, Zeresh, says, since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him, you will surely come to ruin. So I'm wondering, does the original give the sense that there's doubt?
Let's find out.
Because the NIV doesn't give as much.
Yeah, ESV says if also.
So NIV says since, and I'm wondering if the original gives the sense of doubt there.
If you give me a second, I can find it for us. Not that I'm going to ask anybody to read it. Esther. This is chapter 6 and verse 13. Oops. My app is not working right. Let me just find it, though. Yeah, apparently. And actually, where it says, you will surely fall, the Hebrew structure there is intensified. It doubles the verb, which is typically for an intensification. So even when God said to Adam, if you eat of the tree, it you could almost read it a little bit more woodenly, dying you shall die. And here it's sort of along the lines, falling, you shall fall. It's just got that emphasis. We wouldn't really say it. The best way in our language to express that, you will really fall. You shall surely fall. So that's the implication there. But let's see. If Mordecai... Yeah, let me find it. And also is also from the seed.
Yes, from the seed of the Jews.
Yep, from the seed of the Jews. No, it is if. I mean, it's not even one of these words that could have various meanings. It's just the simple Hebrew word if.
So there is that element of doubt that the NIV does not.
In a sense, yeah.
Because the NIV, you read it, and she's just making a statement. Oh, yeah, since he is of Jewish origin, you're going to fall.
Right. But no, the Hebrew is if, not since. So yeah. So all this humorous stuff, then suddenly the seriousness of it comes through. And what God will do to his enemies, what God will do to the proud and the arrogant. And you see all of this providential outworking to bring about the redemption of God's people, the salvation of his covenant people, while at the same time, the destruction of his enemies. That's a common theme throughout redemptive history. You see that over and over again. You think of the great epic moments of redemptive history. Think of the Exodus, passing through the Red Sea, and what also happened, the destruction of Egyptian armies. David and Goliath, the destruction of Goliath, who is the epitome of monstrosity, but through David's hand redeemed the people, and so forth. You can go on and on with this. Joshua in Jericho, and even just going into the Promised Land as a whole. All of the judges. All of these epic moments in redemptive history where the salvation of God's people always seems to go hand in hand with the destruction of God's enemies. And that will come to its final consummation when Christ returns. The ultimate salvation, where right now we enjoy the first fruits. We enjoy in this life the first fruits of salvation, justification, sanctification, adoption, and the several benefits which in this life accompany or flow from them. That's directly out of the Shorter Catechism. But when Christ returns and brings all things to full consummation and draws us to himself, and we have our incorruptible bodies, yet at the same time, those who are the enemies of Christ will be cast into eternal damnation for the final destruction. And you see that picture of Christ in Revelation 19, and it's quite figurative, but nevertheless, it's very chilling in many respects. Because on his robe, it is a robe dipped in blood, literally baptized in blood. The idea of the blood of his enemies being splattered upon his robe. You know, this is our Jesus. Not the effeminate, long, flowy hair that we see in so many ridiculous pictures. You know, as the Bible says, Jesus comes to make war. And he will come. He came first as the lamb to give himself as a sacrifice, but he will return as the lion. And then gather his sheep as the great shepherd. The destruction of his enemies and the salvation of his people. Always going hand in hand, so that you and I may sing the praises of his mighty arm, not our own. And Haman's about to find this out the hard way, very soon. So, any other thoughts or comments? This was a fun story today, wasn't it? And yet, you still have that element of seriousness because you know what's coming. And you know he justly deserves what's coming. So. All right, let's close in prayer then.